It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you. You can always count on Sunday to be the best day of the week. You can sleep in, go off your diet, spend the day in your pajamas, and go on, have that second croissant. You know what else you can count on every Sunday? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. And Season 2 begins Sunday, February 1st. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday relaxing companion, a chance to put your feet up, take a deep breath, and enjoy some stress-free listening time from the comfort of your favorite easy chair. And that second croissant, that stays between us. There's no judgment here. So make my podcast your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And rest assured, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen. So let's keep Sunday the best day of the week together. And thank you for listening.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And we welcome you to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Boy, lots of stuff going on, per usual. The two big stories in Washington, of course, is the government getting back to work and Epstein. We don't have a dog in that fight with Epstein, but I will say that any chaos in the White House, any weakened president, is something that our adversaries keep a very close eye on. And their intelligence services are watching very closely to see how they might take advantage of weakness in Washington. So that is an issue to us to a certain degree. But otherwise, more specific to our concerns are spying operations and the Maduro campaign. And one of the biggest developments on that front is that the Brits have decided they don't want to have anything to do with our Venezuela campaign. They have suspended intelligence cooperation with the United States because they don't think it's moral and legal or fattening. So what do we say about that?
So I just want to just have two little things. So one, we talked a little bit about last week about how Colombia, because of what's going on between the United States and Colombia and this alleged drug war, has also said that, you know, we've alienated that intelligence share, but also Canada. Canada hasn't taken as firm a stance as the UK, but they've also found their way to express their discomfort with it. So the real question is, you know, what are the repercussions of other countries saying, no, we're not going to violate international law. We're not going to help you violate international law. This is not a war, and laws apply.
Yeah, if you're looking for a reason, the Brits, the Canadians, and I'm sure there will be others who are deeply uncomfortable about cooperating with what we are doing in the Caribbean and in the Pacific, look no further than what Hegseth said this week about the latest strike, U.S. military killing six people last Sunday, two more strikes on boats suspected of smuggling drugs in the Eastern Pacific Ocean, and Hegseth on social media posts that the basis for this strike was citing intelligence that these two separate boats that he said were traveling, quote, along a known narco-trafficking transit route in the Eastern Pacific. You know what that means? They don't have specific intelligence about that particular boat. It's a signature strike, which is what the Obama administration was doing with its drone strikes in Pakistan for years, right? It was we don't know exactly who we're firing missiles and killing, but they fit a pattern of activity that suggests that they are up to no good. And we've now taken that from the pure war on terror in Asia, in Pakistan, to this war on drug smuggling in the Caribbean using the same signature strike mentality.
And where does it end?
So just to clarify, I just want to clarify a little bit here, which is that the signature strike was you attack a geographical space rather than individual.
Well, and that there's a pattern of activity by the targets that is suggestive.
But the ultimate result of that is that you don't distinguish between combatants and civilians, which is why the Obama administration eventually moved towards what we call targeted killings now. And you're right. What we're doing now is having first of all, we don't even claim to know who these individuals are in a way that's made public. We don't know the names. We don't know who these people are. And are they And how are we categorizing them? We're categorizing them according to the White House as enemy combatants, but we have no idea if they're combatants and we've completely merged the categories of war and crime. So what I'm saying is that these signature strikes, which was a large category rather than specified guilt and specified facts, is really what we're seeing in the Caribbean writ large again.
You know, we've been fighting this so-called war on drugs for many, many, many decades. And you got to wonder, this is another chapter. How does this play out? I mean, how does Trump declare victory with the death of, say, Maduro? Is that his milestone?
Well, funny you should mention that, since we've got two guests who can talk about assassinations, which seems to be something that the Trump administration talking about.
For sure. We've got tremendous guests out today to address this question. One is Jim Risen, who's a storied reporter from former reporter at the Los Angeles Times, later the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner. He was a member of the New York Times reporting team that won there was a finalist for the 1999 Pulitzer for international reporting. It's for its coverage of the 1998 bombings of embassies in Africa. He was a member of another team that reported on the surveillance, electronic surveillance of Americans. Our other guest is Peter Kornbluh, who is a world-ranking expert on U.S. coup d'etats and assassinations. And is a senior analyst at the privately run National Security Archive at George Washington University. We're talking to them on the 50th anniversary, as it turns out, coincidentally, the 50th anniversary of the so-called Church Committee report on assassinations and the illegal operations of the CIA, FBI, et cetera, drug testing, all sorts of horrors, the family jewels, as they were called back in the day. And so, without further ado, let's bring them both on. Jim Risen and Peter Kornbluh, welcome to Spy Talk, or I should say, welcome back to Spy Talk. You've been our guest before. And the last time we talked, Jim, it was about your 2023 book about Frank Church and the Church Committee, which investigated CIA assassinations and so on and so forth, other abuses by U.S. intelligence. And here we are back on the 50th anniversary of the Church Committee report. And we have Peter Kornbluh, who's, we can say, I think, safely, is a world-ranking expert on assassinations and coup d'etat. close enough. And and we're meeting as the Trump administration sorts out its options for Venezuela, or what it thinks are its options for Venezuela, which may include assassination. So we want to just dig in on this. First of all, Jim, what do you think is going through their mind at the White House?
Well, I think they are nuts, but that's just my opinion. I think, just to bring it back to the Church Committee and to the executive orders on assassinations that came out of that investigation, there's very specific and very legalistic rules under presidential executive orders on assassinations. The ban is on the assassination of foreign leaders, which over the last 20 years has been lawyered up and down by every administration to exclude terrorist organization leaders. And if you recall, after 9/11, the United States began to kill Al-Qaeda leaders. Then in the first Trump administration, they expanded that to kill an Iranian leader. And even though that was probably explicitly illegal under the executive order, they got away with it. And so the problem legally has been that there is no part of the U.S. government that has ever been willing to enforce violations of the executive order banning assassinations.
And we have Obama going after the preacher Al-Awlaki in Yemen with a drone strike. And it seemed like drone strikes, which are assassinations by mechanical means, you might say, have become a regularity in the war on terror.
Right. And I remember during the Clinton administration, when they sent missiles to Afghanistan to try to kill bin Laden, I remember talking to the lawyers at the National Security Council, and they said that they had determined that it did not violate the executive order banning assassinations because they had determined that the leadership of Al-Qaeda was part of the infrastructure of Al-Qaeda, and that they were only going after the infrastructure of Al-Qaeda, which they determined meant people. And so if you are going after the command and control network and infrastructure, they claimed you could say that included the leaders. And so there's a million different legalistic ways that every administration has used to get around the executive order. The executive order came, first in the Carter administration, I believe, and then the Reagan administration. And it was designed to stop what the CIA had been doing all the way back to Eisenhower, and particularly under Kennedy, where they had tried to kill Fidel Castro. And the Church Committee investigated the attempts to kill Castro, as well as several other foreign leaders by the CIA.
Actually, Jim, I think it was President Ford, who signed the first executive order banning assassinations, and that was in 76, right as the Church Committee investigation.
Yeah, and then the Carter
still going on.
Yeah, and then the Carter administration made it
right.
Yeah, stringent, and then the Reagan administration redid it again.
Right, but in talking about the various ways various administrations have tried to get around the executive order, which, by the way, is an executive order. It's not statutory. There is not a statutory ban explicitly on assassinations. But that brings us to what the Trump administration, and in particular, its Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, has been tasked with doing, which is, according to the New York Times, in a groundbreaking piece last week, is exploring OLC drafting an opinion that would authorize make acceptable an assassination of Maduro. And I'm just reading from the Times account here, while the guidance is still being drafted, some administration officials expect will argue that Maduro and his top security officials are central figures in the Cartel de los Soles, which the administration has designated as a narco-terrorist group. The Justice Department is expected to contend that designation makes Maduro a legitimate target, despite longstanding American legal prohibitions on assassinating national leaders. Peter, you saw that language and had a pretty strong reaction, if I recall.
Well, you know, what we're talking about is the 50th anniversary of one of the most extraordinary, revealing deep dives into CIA covert operations and assassination plots that was published on November 20th, 1975, led almost immediately an uproar across the country and forcing President Gerald Ford to sign an executive order explicitly banning U.S. CIA forces and other forces from targeting foreign leaders for assassination outside of the parameters of wartime fighting. And you have basically a long period of time, all the way through to 9/11, essentially, of the whole idea of assassinating foreign leaders being completely taboo based on the scandal of the Church Committee findings 50 years ago. Now, in the post 9/11 world, things started to change. Terrorists, bona fide terrorists, were source targets for assassination. And what President Trump has done is he is labeling the leader of Venezuela, the head of state of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, as a terrorist, a narco-terrorist. And this is kind of a new concept that has come to pass. And by doing so, there's this legalese idea that somehow he'll be able to circumvent the kind of the taboo against simply picking up and deciding we're going to assassinate a foreign leader by designating him a narco-terrorist. And openly discussing this, that's the amazing thing, you know, for all that history that the Church Committee revealed to us, that was all top secret and had been top secret for years and years and years. Now we have a president who's basically willing to just discuss it openly. As he told 60 Minutes, you know, Nicolas Maduro's days are numbered. And it's clear that this whole operation in the Caribbean that we're watching unfold right now is basically a protracted attempt to take down, eliminate, neutralize, liquidate, as the CIA used to say, the head of state of Venezuela.
Let me ask you, Peter, wasn't one of the main concerns is that if you have a policy of assassinating foreign leaders, they can bounce back on you? They can assassinate. There's a green light for anyone to assassinate the president of the United States.
Yeah, I don't see that in the arguments that were necessarily made at the time. It's interesting to go read the Church Committee report, which was titled Alleged Assassination Plots Involving Foreign Leaders. This was the first interim report that the committee released. It released a second report just on covert operations in Chile. And then in 1976, in the spring of 76, it released multiple volumes on the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, FBI, et cetera, the whole intelligence community. But, you know, the repudiation of the assassination efforts was fast and furious. Gerald Ford publicly repudiated assassination attempts. William Colby, the director of the CIA, repudiated assassination plots. It was a bad idea from a foreign policy state of view because it certainly was telling about the kind of ethical and moral issues of U.S. foreign policy. I think obviously the national security system is always concerned about the president of the United States being assassinated by foreign forces. But it wasn't as if this was going to be the thing that opened the door to it. It obviously was not in keeping with the reputation that the United States wanted to portray itself having around the world.
Well, I have a question for Jim, just to follow up on this, which is that you know, in theory, we have these restrictions, prohibitions on assassination, or reflections on what went wrong in the past. But there really has been, since the beginning of the war on terror and escalated under Obama's drone strikes and under the attack on Soleimani, a sense that there are, that you can confuse the legal argument if you need to. And I'm just curious, as we see so much being rolled back about law and order over the past decades. And you know, remember when the Soleimani strike happened, the Trump administration confused everybody by invoking a whole bunch, a wide range of legal justifications without actually coming to a consensus. So part of what's happening here is the has been the refusal to have a legal justification for things, just doing it and then in retrospect finding it. It looks like now they're really working on a legal justification that will have some kind of strategy and stature. And so my question to you is, do you think we're really going to take this leap and have a new way of justifying things, or and what will that mean in terms of how you understand the legacy of the Church Committee?
Those are good questions. I think the Soleimani thing is the closest to what you're now talking about, because Soleimani was an Iranian government official, a very senior government official, but they claimed that the IRGC that he ran, which was part of the Iranian government, was a terrorist organization. And so the justification, the legal justification for that strike was that he was a terrorist, which sounds very similar to what they're now saying about Maduro. I think the main reason that the government in the 1970s didn't want to continue with assassinations, and the reason why the Ford administration was so willing to go along with the Church Committee's findings and get rid of this legacy, was that it was considered abhorrent and immoral, and that it harmed America's standing in the world. The question now is, certainly Donald Trump doesn't seem to care about America's standing in the world. He only thinks about hard power and not soft power, not cultural or moral power. And that is that's the real change. Are we going to be a country that no longer values soft power in any way?
We have to step away for a sec. We'll be back shortly.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Okay, we're back.
Just on the assassination question, I think it is interesting to watch the slippery slope here where we start the justification for the Soleimani hit, who was a senior government official, was he was head of the IRGC. The IRGC is a terrorist group, and therefore terrorist groups that threaten the United States. And in fact, IRGC did attack, was attacking American troops in Iraq. So there was a actual threat of violence against Americans with Soleimani. To take it to Maduro, now you've gone to another level because he's allegedly the head of a drug organization. He's trafficking drugs. They're calling that terrorism because
Well, Mike, can I just insert here one of the part of the justification that's been reported, and again, we don't know, we haven't seen the OLC memo, yeah, but part of what's been reported in the press is that the Maduro accusation is not about just the drug cartels and selling drugs. It's about using the proceeds and money from the drug sales to incite violence within the United States. They're taking another level. I just wanted to add,
but they're bringing it to another level. It's attenuated. It's drug trafficking, which is normally thought of as a law enforcement issue, and now they're equating that with terrorism.
Which is a leap. It's a terrible escalation, because it means that basically you can say you can find some legal justification for anybody. And that's the real danger.
Right.
Peter, right. I wonder, in your study of various coup d'etats and assassination plots and so on, whether what was the lesson learned for leaders? I mean, as we've discussed, various presidents with bipartisan abhorrence of assassinations. I'm trying to put my finger on why was that? Was that at an entirely different time, a moral relativity where we, as a nation coming out of Vietnam and Watergate and so on, said we got to draw the line and become a more moral place? Was that part of the discussion that developed over the decades?
Certainly. When this scandal broke in 1975, it was right at the time when the United States was being defeated in Vietnam, and the whole discussion about U.S. foreign policy was, you know, front and foremost in all the newspapers. And the CIA scandals came on top of that whole sensibility that the American public had developed about everything that was wrong about Vietnam, the atrocities committed there, the My Lai massacre, et cetera, the, you know, death of so many young U.S. soldiers. And here comes the CIA scandals. First, the scandal of the CIA overthrowing Allende in Chile, then the domestic spying scandal, then Gerald Ford himself letting slip that, you know, there were other scandals, other skeletons in the CIA closet. And somebody in an off-the-record briefing said to him, like, what? And he said, like, assassinations. And that ended up spinning into the whole scandal of the CIA's biggest skeleton at the time, you know, its efforts to kill Diem in Vietnam, Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, General Rene Schneider, the commander-in-chief of the Chilean Armed Forces in October 1970, who stood in the way of a Kissinger-desired coup. And Fidel Castro, the nemesis of the United States. And all of this was done during an era, as Spy Talk has taught us again and again and again, of plausible denial and very ultra-secret covert operations. And suddenly, from 1975 onward, from the Church Committee reports onward, we had the revelations. We had finally the information to try and determine whether having a kind of unleashed covert capacity that ended up being used to kill foreign leaders and among so many other elements of regime change around the world was in keeping with the democratic sensibilities of the United States of America. And that sensibility held for quite some time, although, you know, it stayed with many of us. I guess we have to remember that only a few years, like 6 years after the Church Committee reports came out, we had the open, overt, covert war of the Contras in Nicaragua and another effort at regime change, paramilitary effort. So, you know, in a sense that the CIA has continued on and covert operations have continued on. But what we don't have anymore since then is this idea of real plausible denial. And President Trump has taken this to a completely different level. He's not trying to deny anything. He's trying to legalistically apply the idea that the United States should be able to kill basically whoever it wants. And I should point out that even though they're not leaders, the United States, under Trump's orders, have turned the Caribbean into a killing field. And basically, the Pentagon has become a serial killer, now assassinating 75 individuals who are in these little boats, some of which are ferrying cocaine bales to other boats or to Trinidad and Tobago, not coming to the United States. And some of them perhaps not even doing anything. The United States, right. Trump has become judge, jury, and executioner.
The whole basis of the assault of the campaign is skewed.
So, yeah. Jim, you know, we remember the Church Committee today because what it uncovered was shocking on many levels, but it was also wild. I mean, the lengths to which the CIA went and the imaginative means it tried to use to kill foreign leaders, in particular two, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and then, of course, Castro in Cuba, you know, biological toxins, exploding cigars. Walk us through a little just what the Church Committee found about the two major assassinations that they did conclude were plotted by the CIA, even if they never went to fruition. And that's Lumumba and Castro. Let's start with Lumumba. Tell us who he was and why the CIA was trying to kill him.
Sure. Well, I mean, Schneider in Chile was, there were a lot of plots that never succeeded, but there were plenty of people who they plotted against and then died. Patrice Lumumba was the freedom fighter in the Congo who became the leader of the Congo against the wishes of the Belgian government, which had been still thought of Congo as their colony, even though it was now free in the early 1960s, supposedly. And the CIA was working with the Belgian government, as well the Belgian army, as well as local counter-revolutionary leaders in the Congo to stage a coup against Lumumba. The coup, eventually he was forced out of power, put under house arrest, and the question then became what to do with him. He was under UN protection at the time. UN peacekeeping soldiers were surrounding the house where he was under house arrest in Leopoldville, and he escaped. Some believe because he was kind of pressured to leave the house, and was captured and then taken to Katanga, the area where of the Congo that was most under the control of Belgian forces, and was immediately executed. And his body was stuck into a vat of acid.
Talk a little about what they uncovered about what the CIA did. I mean, they sent biological toxins to the Congo, to the station chief in the Congo.
Right. The reason I was recounting that other narrative is that ultimately the CIA did not kill him. He was killed by Katanga and Belgian forces after he'd been kidnapped on his way out of Leopoldville. But the CIA certainly worked with those forces to try to locate him and had planned to kill him. They had sent toxins to the CIA station in the Congo, and they wanted the station chief to use it to find somebody who would poison him. They also, when the station chief was reluctant to do so, they then sent a hitman to the Congo to try to kill Lumumba. It's possible that that hitman helped kind of scare or pressure people around Lumumba to get him out of the house where he was under house arrest and under UN protection, which then made him more vulnerable. But it took about 20 or 30 years for all of the facts of that case to come out. And the CIA's role within this very complicated situation was not fully known by the Church Committee. But what they did know was that the toxins had been delivered by Sidney Gottlieb, the head chief scientist of the CIA at the time, to the station chief, who took them and refused to actually use them to poison.
I think that wasn't the plan to put the toxin in his toothpaste or something.
Yeah, I think they had a number of different plans.
Yeah, a number of ways. By the way, who was the hitman?
Guy named, well, his code name was QJ Wynn. And his name has never been fully vetted exactly. He was probably either French or from somewhere else in northern Europe. But he was a hitman that the CIA used occasionally and had also been involved in other with other intelligence services. He was kind of the, if you ever saw the movie 3 Days of the Condor, he's a lot like the character, the hitman in that movie.
Well, I was watching Day of the Jackal the other night. It was on TMC, and that's the classic of a hitman in Europe. So that was Lumumba, and then we get to Castro, and
The Castro situation is much different because they tried innumerable ways to kill him, starting with the Eisenhower administration, and then continuing through the Kennedy administration. And perhaps even some in the Johnson administration. The first major plan and the biggest plan that the Church Committee investigated was at the end of the Eisenhower administration, the CIA began to plot with this with the mafia to kill Castro. And they created an alliance between the CIA and some of the most important mobsters in America, who all got together in Miami. And they tried to figure out a way to get poisons into Castro's food or drink. And they actually received poison pills from the CIA that they planned to give to have Castro take. But the guy, the Cuban who they gave them to, lost his nerve. And it's also possible, I think, that they keep trying to keep coming up with other plots through the mafia. But it's very possible that some of the mobsters were double dealing because they wanted to continue to work in Cuba, try to work with Castro to get their casinos reopened. And so there's been a lot of speculation over the years that they weren't really trying to kill Castro. They wanted to work with the CIA to try to get the federal government off of their backs for further investigation.
Can I just follow up here with just a question, which is that, and it came up a little earlier, but are we really talking in the same context now? I mean, I understand the, alleged assassination attempts in the past and the church committee and, but really right now, we're not really, are we still talking about covert operations? We're not really,
Didn't Trump sign a covert finding for covert ops for the CIA?
Yeah, he overtly signed a covert operations thing that he made very public. But what I'm really trying to say is that I think more or equal to what's happened in the past we're talking about is also how the war on terror completely changed the paradigm of who we're allowed to kill, how we're allowed to kill them, and under what legal justifications. And I'm interested in what Peter and Jim have to think about this in their long history of, the retrospective and how we think about assassinations, just how much of a game changer the war on terror was in sort of canceling out many of the moral and legal restrictions that we had in the past. And I'm just curious what both of them think.
I just want to, before Peter says, as you were talking, it reminded me of one of my few epiphanies during the covering the war on terror was the mistake. In hindsight, it looks like the political mistake that George Bush made in the war on terror was to try to capture people. And Barack Obama took the lesson from that. The lesson was, why capture people and put them in prisons? Why not just kill them? And that was the big change between the Bush and the Obama administrations. Bush got a lot of heat justifiably so, for capturing people and torturing them. And the Obama administration just decided to predator the shit out of them. And they found that nobody cared anymore. If you killed a lot of people in Waziristan with a predator and nobody saw it, you could get away with it politically. And that was the dangerous, incredibly dangerous lesson that Barack Obama learned from the Bush administration and which we are now living with today.
I think that's a good point, but also it points to the fact that the machinery of death has evolved, and the drone capabilities have become extremely sophisticated, and that technology shift, you know, really became defined between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Now, drone warfare is really very appealing, just like covert operations was appealing previously in the old era to presidents. It's the easiest, cheapest, safest way to, you know, promote our interests and our murderous interests in other countries. I did want to make a comparison between the then and now about assassination techniques in the CIA. Some of you and your listeners might remember that I wrote a piece for Spy Talk about the very first CIA effort to assassinate Castro, but it wasn't Fidel Castro, it was Raul Castro. Mm-hmm. And the CIA was trying to bribe a pilot that it had on its payroll who was going to be flying Raul Castro to Moscow, to Czechoslovakia and to Moscow and back. They offered him $10,000 to basically create an accident, ditch the plane, perhaps in the water. When he said to them, you know, that sounds like a suicide mission, their response was, well, if something happens to you, we will assure you that we will pay for your son's college tuitions in the United States. And you have the most recent kind of revelation of CIA operations against Maduro in Venezuela, where they also tracked down a pilot and basically tried to bribe him to kind of divert his plane to an area where they could capture or take out Nicolas Maduro. And he did not agree. And that kind of little tidbit of a covert operation gone awry has now made it to the public domain. But these are two episodes, you know, more than 65 years apart. And they do speak to the continuity of covert operations approaches.
But that brings up another issue. We know about that, whereas so much of the CIA's covert action and assassination plots, we didn't know about for decades. And suddenly, you know, in real time, the CIA offers Maduro's pilot a bribe, and we learn about it 48 hours later.
The thing about Trump is that he doesn't like to keep secrets like this because he wants to brag about
it. That's true.
And it makes you wonder that what is the purpose under a man like Trump of the CIA? Because the CIA is supposed to do secret things, but he doesn't like secrets. He wants to brag. And so we might as well just have the Pentagon. He doesn't, you know, the CIA is really kind of a bankrupt organization under someone like Trump, who hates secrets. And so once everything is out in the open, it's just a military operation. And
well, there's a lot of that going on right now.
Well, one thing's not out in the open, which is the OLC opinion that we were referring to at the beginning. I mean, if that, you know, in terms of everything being out in the open, it would be nice to see the legal justification that they're actually using. We have a lot of guesses to how they're thinking about how the issue of killings, both in terms of the boats and in terms of threats to Maduro.
Yeah, I don't think Trump cares much about that. Opinion schminions.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He's going to do what he wants to
you
do.
You don't think he's fly-specking OLC opinions to
well, then why
reach
did they
his
even
conclusions
ask?
About what to do?
Yeah.
I think the reason they ask for an OLC opinion is because the people who are actually down in the bureaucracy want some legal cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And That is the real issue for all of the people who are doing Trump's bidding today. Is you have to, in order to do these things, in order to go kill foreign leaders, you have to make a bet that the United States government's position on these issues is not going to change in the near future and you won't be prosecuted.
Well, is it the United States government's position or the Supreme Court's position? Because given the Supreme Court's immunity ruling, basically anything the president does, including ordering the assassination of somebody, is an official action that is presumptively immune. The big unanswered question on the point you're making, Jim, is how does that apply to subordinates who get asked to do something illegal by a president who is protected from legality by the Supreme Court?
There are caveats in that immunity ruling that could open Trump up to future prosecution if he does something that is so blatantly illegal that even the court's ruling won't cover it. I don't think he cares, but I do think that there's a real possibility that there'll be a need for a new church committee when we have a new, if we ever get a real government again.
Do you have a sense of who might be in the leadership? Like who would be the Frank Church of our times?
Perhaps Tim Kaine is a possibility. Adam Schiff has already played that role in a sense.
I
think that there are people inside the U.S. government that remember the Church Committee better than most Americans do. And that's why it's so important to bring it up. There was an effort at accountability through obtaining documentation and revealing what it said. And we may pass through another era as we're being taken into an extraordinarily immoral and unaccountable era of U.S. foreign policy. We may arrive back at a reckoning, and that will be very important. And the Church Committee will be a model for what needs to happen.
I think we've had two committees in the last few years that came close. One was the Senate investigation of torture. The other was the January 6th House Committee. I think the Dianne Feinstein's investigation of torture was so weak and so easily pressured by the CIA that it raises questions about whether another real investigation of intelligence operations could be very aggressive. And I'm not sure how far down the road anybody's willing to go again with the Church Committee.
We can only hope that we get back to a normal government.
For those who want to know what the Church Committee did, Jim's book is still available, The Last Honest Man, the CIA, the FBI, the Mafia, and the Kennedys, and One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy. And if you're looking for underlying material, national security documents, go to Peter's National Security Archive, and you can find a lot of the underlying material. I want to thank you both for an illuminating and important discussion.
Can I make one point, which is Peter and the National Security Archive just released Sidney Gottlieb's testimony.
Yeah.
To the Church Committee.
I was reading it this morning. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
It's great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's another interesting
Spy Talk nerds. I know where to go.
I have a feeling
we'll have you guys back again. You're great fonts of wisdom on these questions. So thanks for coming on, spending your time with us.
Yeah. Thanks, you guys.
All right. Happy 50th anniversary of the Church Committee's first report.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there.
This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth. It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.